This episode is brought to you by Mutinex Growth OS,
the marketing mix modeling platform that makes measuring ROI fast, easy, and cost effective. And this is my best radio voice.
That's the most creative thing you've ever said.
How's this for a call to action?
Mutinex Growth OS, your best decisions start here. Request a demo at mutinex.co. That's mutinex.co.
It's about looking at things with an imagination and inventiveness, you know, doing something differently. And in business today, the most important thing is to be able to distinguish yourself. How do we think about the way we deconstruct problems differently? How do we be open to where possibilities around solutions lie?
Welcome back to Black T-Shirts. Today on the show,
we've got an awesome guest, Nikki Sparshot. She was the CEO of Unilever here in Australia and New Zealand. She's now the global chief of transformation for Unilever. She's very passionate about purpose and how it can be an absolute driver of business performance. She's made Unilever a B Corp here in Australia. She's also brought in the four-day week, both of which have been incredibly positive moves. It's another story of a marketer who's gone all the way to CEO. And it's great to talk to Nikki today. Nikki Sparshot, welcome to Black T-Shirts. Are you wearing a black T-shirt?
Yes, you can see I'm wearing a black T-shirt always in honor of this show.
Oh, that's very kind. That doesn't sound like the wardrobe choice of a high-flying, powerful CEO come global transformation officer.
Oh, well, it totally is. I can tell you, I am happiest in my T-shirt, jeans, and some trainers. So yeah, that's the guilty secret right there.
And why? Why black T-shirts?
It's just chilled, it's relaxed, and actually it's one less thing to take off your to-do list. You know, I'm all about how do I relieve cognitive load, but I can focus on the stuff that actually matters.
I'm getting worried about this because everybody is starting to adopt the black T-shirt and everybody has the same excuse of cognitive load.
We've started something. Are we claiming it? Our podcast has created a black T-shirt movement.
Have I spoken about this before, Brent? But in every single image or science fiction movie set in the future, which they often are, everybody is wearing the same thing and everybody walks in unison and everyone has the same haircut and they've all got spandex pants put up to their armpits or something weird like that. And it's always kind of uniform pressures that homogenize us. And I worry that that the black T-shirt, the symbol of creativity is being asserted, become the new symbol of uniformity.
Well, interesting. But you would be for that, given your previous advice about fitting in is the most important thing.
It is. Hey, Nikki, I think you're our first CEO. But on a podcast, it's all about creativity. You're a CEO who is going to talk a little bit about that today. So you're both the creative outcast and the leader of a very large organization. What were you like at school?
Yeah, well, you know what? When I was at school, I was that person that was, you know, into writing poems and taking, you know, dead birds off the street and burying them in my backyard and, you know, hanging out with friends and dressing up and putting together dance routines. Like this sort of notion of creativity was a sort of thread through my childhood. But tell you what, as a kid, I didn't grow up thinking I want to be a CEO or I want to be a creative CEO. But there are a few sort of telltale signs when I think about my childhood. You know, the first one was I was that kid that was, you know, putting together the lemonade stands and thinking about how I could make money on the street. And then I kind of migrated to the cake stall at the, you know, local supermarket and then, you know, bedazzling and, you know, T-shirts that I would then send. So this idea of kind of putting together beautiful things that people were prepared to buy was always part of my ethos. I was always a little bit of the activist, right? I remember, you know, telling my friends and my mom at about the age of 16 that I was staying at a girlfriend's house. And it would have been fine, except that next morning I'd come back home and she and my dad had seen me protesting for Indigenous land rights on the streets of Sydney. So this sort of activist side of me was always live and kicking. And then, of course, I grew up in a very middle-class but highly multicultural environment. So this, you know, notion of diversity and different influences culturally and otherwise was very much part of my childhood. And when I think about those three things, business, you know, activism and standing up for something that I'm passionate about, and then celebrating diversity and all the creativity that comes with that, then yeah, I guess that is something that I've taken into my career.
That's pretty cool. And how does the picking up dead birds, where does that, how does that fit? How does that
I don't even need it. Even as I said that, I thought this is going to get analysed over and over again. No, I kind of missed it. I had my little bike with my basket at the front of it, and I would see, you know, animals that had been sort of left on the side of the road, and I'd pack them in my basket, bring them home, and bury them in the backyard. I don't know. Let's put it down to my environmental sensibility and just my explains why I'm now sitting on the board of WWF.
Yeah. That's right. But there used to be a thing called the psychopathic triad, but they used to think that if kids were cruel to animals, wet their bed, and I can't remember the third thing, about those three things, and they're going to grow up to be a psychopath. But I think
and want to work in advertising. Was that?
I can't even remember the third thing. It'll come in.
I mean, just to be super clear for all your listeners, I was saving and burying the animals, not killing them. Yes, to be super clear.
That was clear to me, Nikki. That was clear to me. So you didn't want to be a CEO, but what did you want to be when you were growing up? What did you think your sort of future career would be?
And that's like, honestly, I went from, you know, I wanted to be an actress at one point in time to, you know, maybe I become a nun to wanting to be a doctor. Like, I think the reality was I was not entirely sure. And in many ways, when I think back about my career, it has been, yes, there's been some intention around choices made, but a lot of it has been a bit of serendipity and saying yes to opportunities that presented themselves. And I tell you what I've always been more passionate about. It's what are the experiences that I can step into that are going to add more and differentiating tools in my toolkit, so to speak, so that, you know, when I look back at my career or when I step into a role, I've got like a few different types of levers that I can pull and not just sort of have come down this very linear career path. So, yeah, you know, it's a funny thing. When I remember asking my daughter that, she's now 18, but we were reflecting on it recently as she was picking up what to do for uni. And I, you know, when she was about four, I said to her, what do you want to be? And she said, I know exactly, either a mermaid or a doctor.
Or a doctor. That's great.
A mermaid or a doctor. Yeah.
Nikki, our paths first crossed when we co-ran a course in advertising many moons ago, but you would have been a senior marketer, mid to senior marketer at Unilever. I can't remember where you were at the time. But you had volunteered your time after hours to do this course for the advertising community. And I can remember everyone being so excited that they had a marketer training doing the advertising. And when you just said, you know, saying yes to opportunity. So that was my experience of you. So you're volunteering to do that after hours, which is quite a big time commitment. Tell us a bit about that and a bit about trying to just kind of push yourself into those kind of areas or roles or things that you aren't going to get an immediate return on. Are you doing it just to see what's interesting? Are you doing it because you know that it's going to pay back? What gets you into those kind of things?
It's twofold. One, that was a super fun experience doing that with you then. And I think I'm big on reciprocity, right? I think if I can generously contribute some of the experiences that I've had to others, then I like to do that. Part of sort of how I've been raised myself, and I like to be able to do that. And at the same time, every time I have chosen to do that, I feel like I've had tenfold back. So if that, you know, opportunity presents itself, I typically find that I learn as much as I give. And, you know, in that particular moment, listening to that next generation of students that are going through also keeps you current, keeps you recent. And you know, you fast forward now to today and, you know, without wanting to sound cliched, but the pace of change is unprecedented. So I actually think putting yourself in environments that keep you current, that challenge your own thinking, that bring different perspectives to the table afford you then more creative solutions to the problems that we face every day. I mean, even in my role today, and I have done this for quite some time, like I'm quite into reverse mentoring. You know, where can I, you know, mentor somebody on, you know, something that I've got a perhaps a superpower in? But more importantly, where can I learn from 20-something-year-olds on areas that are, you know, not native to my own capability, be that, you know, how to leverage agile methodology or how to, you know, implement social selling, how to, you know, leverage, you know, digital in a way that I haven't thought about. You know, I think that is really important. So put yourself in situations where you can give generously, but you can learn really curiously as well.
And besides the sort of some of the capability stuff just talked about, like that young people have great understanding of, what else do you get when you talk to young people in terms of the way they think about work, the way they think about brands, the way they think about, you know, the world? Like there's also a different mindset there, right?
I mean, I think they've, you know, they've got so much more choice to start with. They've got access to many more mediums of information communication than ever before. They've got, in many ways, they've got a lot more conviction around what they're passionate about, what matters to them. And, you know, I think, you know, I talk to my own kids, they look at things differently. Like we were quite linear in the way we built our careers. We were quite structured around hierarchy and the need to do things and in a certain way. They're much more open in many ways, much more intuitive about opting in and out of different experiences that, you know, can enrich their lives, their careers, et cetera. So, yeah, look, so there's not a sexy answer. I think it's just about curious, right? It is just about keeping yourself curious and listening. We massively underrate the importance of genuine listening to other people.
Speaking of putting yourself in unusual situations, there aren't that many, although it's becoming more popular, CMOs making the transition to a CEO.
It's not becoming more popular. It's becoming harder than ever.
No, it's becoming more popular. There's a 20% increase year on year, basically.
So it's gone from 2% to 2.2%. That's a 20% increase. It is a very rare thing. And if you look at the background of most CEOs, particularly in this country, it's predominantly finance or operations, very rarely marketing. Right, Nikki?
I mean, look, that is the case. And yet there should be more marketeers making the transition, right?
100%.
If you think about, well, at the end of the day, what do you do as an organization? You want to create demand for your product because you're offering something that's unmissably awesome in the marketplace. And so somebody who starts with a real people that you serve orientation can help to make that focus on consumer so much part of your organization. So I would like to see more of it. I also think, though, in making that transition from CMO to CEO, we also need CMOs to be really commercially savvy. So yes, I understand, you know, the people that you serve and how to reach them, but also know deeply the economics of doing that well. And I think that's the magic of both. And yeah, we absolutely need to see more CMOs taking up that mantle.
And continuing the trend of more CMOs becoming CEOs.
I don't know where you get that data from, but like, it's not true. But just coming back to what Nikki just said, right? Because I think the commercial things are given, right? You want to run a company, you need to be commercial. And there are obviously really commercial people sitting around the table from you, like CFO and so forth. Where does creativity come into it? Where does being more creative, looking at things in creative ways, coming up with creative solutions, do you think that's something that sets you apart as a CEO and sets apart people who come with a marketing background versus, let's say, a finance or an operations or a more corporate background?
Yeah, because at the end, what is creativity? At the end of the day, it's about, you know, it's about looking at things with an imagination and inventiveness, you know, doing something differently. And in business today, the most important thing is to be able to distinguish yourself. To be able to look at the multitudes of challenges and problems that we're confronted with but to be able to convert them into opportunities. So yeah, you need to have creativity across all dimensions of your business, but that sort of culture of creativity that says, how do we think about the way we deconstruct problems differently? How do we be open to where possibilities around solutions lie? How do we harness lots of different perspectives to help us craft that? But I think creativity also makes you a bit more resilient, right? If, you know, just that ability to be more imaginative and to bring fun into the heart of your organization allows people to be much more resilient. We underestimate the power of fun, right? And play in unlocking problems in an organization.
I do think on the resilient thing's really interesting, right? I think that's a very underappreciated thing that you need if you're going to be creative, because obviously not every idea gets through, right? Like you do need to have that resilience to keep putting yourself out there, to keep bringing ideas. And of course, the best ideas seem pretty crazy when you first come up with them, and they meet all sorts of resilience and doubt and you know, nervousness. So I think that's a really interesting thought, that creative people are more resilient. Do you want to unpack that a bit more for us?
I mean, you guys know this even better than I do, but it's like a funnel, right? You want to put a lot of creative ideas into the top of the funnel. It's not a tunnel. It's a funnel, right? So not everything can get through.
Not a tunnel. It's a funnel. I love it.
You know what I mean, though? But like we need to be able to think really big and then very systematically start to narrow things down that we think are going to create the most value ultimately. Because, you know, and I'm a bit of a believer in, you know, stop starting, start finishing. At some point, pick your big bets, but then go big or go home, right? Be famous for those big bets that you actually make. And you got to have some really good creative firepower, whether it be in innovation or communication or even just the way you commercially conceive of business models, so that you can make some of those big bets really create value for the business that you're in.
I think it's interesting. I think at the moment, though, one of the things CMOs need to do is be a bit more resilient, because their jobs are getting taken by CCOs. And I find this really interesting.
As in, just for the listeners, Adam, Chief Customer Officer, yeah?
That's right. So Chief Customer Officers are now getting the job of looking at the consumer from internally in the organization right through to current customers and then to, potential customers, I guess. And that, I thought, was the job of the Chief Marketing Officer. So they're getting, it feels like the Chief Customer Officer is coming in on top of the Chief Marketing Officer in lots of organizations. And I feel like that's a function of the organization not getting what a brand's about, thinking it needs somebody else to make the brand live through the entire organization, whereas that should be the role of the Chief Marketing Officer, right?
So that's an interesting reflection. Interestingly, at Unilever, we've just gone and put in an awesome new CMO, actually. Gone really back to that true demand.
Back to the future.
There's never anything new, right? But perhaps, Adam, it goes back to that imperative, and we can, you can put titles on anything, but it goes back to that imperative of a marketeer really putting the people they serve first, the brands that they craft off the back of the insights around what's going to, make consumers' lives better, but doing that with a really end-to-end understanding of the consumer journey, the customer journey, and the commercial journey, right? Being able to hold all those things true.
And why do you think the end-to-end bit of that understanding has been devalued within organizations, and marketers are just focusing on the AMP, the promotional bit of the P's?
I think it's to some extent also depends on the type of organization, right? And the way it's set up. Fast moving consumer goods businesses probably tend to be more end to end in the way that they think about demand creation anyway, at least in my experience. I'm not sure about others, but it's, the risk is this though, when you just look at marketing as one part of the business, it becomes a cost center, right? Then it becomes, it's a bit diminished, right? They'll go and do the sexy brand stuff, but somehow it may or may not create value. Whereas when you make it more end to end, then you're very, very quickly saying, we see this not as a cost center, but as an investment in value creation today and tomorrow. Because actually we're creating tangible and intangible value in our brands, and there's real merit in that. So it depends what the orientation of the organization is in that regard. But I very much believe, that's why, you know, for the sake of not being too repetitive, but I think it does come back to demand creation. How do you create demand for the products or services that you have? And the role of the marketeer in deeply understanding how to craft that in a way that creates commercial value.
I'm going to now ask a difficult question. But there's a somebody in our organization who's just done her PhD in sustainability and marketing and the interrelationship between those two things. And she's constantly asking us all, what's the role of marketing in a post-growth world where we can't keep on growing? What do marketers do? Does that question make sense? Do you have a point of view on that?
Yeah, this is, this sort of idea that can we be expecting people to buy more stuff more often into perpetuity so that every year we're driving growth, right? And this is also where I think, well, you want to be the consumer first brand of choice, like across a myriad of options that people can choose. Probably over time, there is going to be continued consolidation. You know, there was a time where your competition was like a big elephant coming through a jungle, right? You could kind of see it coming and you could plan for it arriving, right? You had some time. And then we moved into this, it was like little black jellyfish nipping at you.
That's a fish head.
Coming from everywhere, like lots of little small brands sort of eating your lunch, and you couldn't plan and react as quickly as you did before. And now I feel, you know, so the pendulum swings both ways, but I kind of think we're now moving a little bit more into some of these big brands are beautiful again because they offer quality, integrity, scale, trust, assurance, things that people are really craving right now. So my answer to that is, you know, in a world where probably growth can't continue unconstrained, especially if as organizations we want to be environmentally conscious, contributing to social causes and delivering exceptional financial return, then you need to be the very best in the domain that you're in. You need to have the highest quality. And when you do that, you might sell a little bit less, but you might sell it at a higher price because you're worth what it costs. And this stuff all matters.
Well, categories might shrink, but one or two brands will still be able to grow, but the entire category might have a smaller footprint.
But I also think what Nikki just said there about being able to charge more, I don't think enough marketers think about that or talk about that. I think we get so obsessed with, as you say, out of growth and demand, and yeah, that's all important. But what the great marketers and great brands do is they enable you to charge more. And I would have thought, that's a very strategic thing that marketing can do. And also, what CFO wouldn't enjoy the marketer talking about that? We're going to increase margin. You know, I mean, I think it's not talked about enough by marketers, right?
Yeah. And look, that margin expansion piece is really important. It's important from a whole lot of different angles. Yes, it's important because some of that flows through to the bottom line and it, you know, creates value for the business. It creates shareholder return, all of that kind of very important commercial stuff. But investing in margin also allows you to innovate and invest in IP and technology. Investing in more margin allows you to create more purpose in your brand so you can have a regenerative impact on the planet, because actually making investments in sustainability sometimes does cost you in the short term.
So profit is good, because a lot of people want to say it's bad and these big companies make too much money. And so you would say... And of course, some are, right? Some are just in it for profit and that's it. But you would say, no, hang on a minute. If we made more money, we can actually do more good. Yeah, that's what you would fundamentally believe as as someone who's, you know, very senior at Unilever and as you know, be very passionate about purpose and doing good, yeah. But you would say there's a link there between more money actually can mean more good.
So for me, purpose-led does not mean profit-deprived, right?
Right.
So we need to be able to do both well. And when we do both well, it's like a virtuous cycle. So as a business, of course, we need to deliver financial outcomes that create value. I don't think we should apologize for that. It is important as an organization that we do deliver financial return. And when we do that, we get license and we also get liquidity to be able to invest in the planet and people stuff and create that virtuous cycle. And when you get your purpose right, like firstly, you have to have a kick-ass good product, right? Let's be honest. Your product needs to do what it says on the box exceptionally well, or your service. You've got to start with that. And then, you know, when you can overlay a purpose on top of that, then that can also create profit. Right. We know that purpose-led brands tend to outperform those that don't, particularly with a younger cohort and actually, interestingly enough, a much older cohort who are much more values aligned. They're actively choosing brands that align to their values or actively not choosing brands that where there's a misalignment. So, yeah, it's a really good point. And then, if I go back to Big is Beautiful again, you know, the more you grow, the more profit you can make, the more good you can do.
This episode is brought to you by Mutinex.
Are you going to start talking about Mutinex again?
Yep. It's that amazing marketing mix modeling platform that helps marketers make better investment decisions.
I thought it was more complicated than that.
No, not according to the script. They measure the true impact of marketing on your bottom line using clever computers and people.
Mutinex Growth OS. Your best decisions start here. For more information or to request a demo, visit mutinex.co. That's mutinex.co.
We know Henry too. We had him on the show. Great bloke. 97% human, 3% cyborg.
I just think what's super important, where I get really agitated, is when people ask you to make a choice. You could only do one or the other. You know, businesses have a fiduciary responsibility to deliver financial and shareholder return only. And someone else should do the other stuff. And I think, honestly, that's really lazy. That's not good enough. We need to be able to do both.
Yeah. One of our friends of the show, Mark Britson, says the purpose of purpose is purpose. But it can't be that. The purpose of purpose has to be profit, because or else the business goes out of business and can't be purpose. So one should feed the other, I think is what you're saying.
Yeah.
You're not just talking about this. You've acted like this in a very strong way. In fact, in a world leading way. You're the CEO of Unilever Australia New Zealand and made them, I think at the time, the biggest organization in the world, kind of B Corp organization, which is incredible. Tell us about how did you decide to do that and how did that happen? But how can you move such a big business? It's a quite, maybe it tells us a little bit about what's involved in becoming B Corp.
Yeah, sure. So for those of you listeners that don't know what a B Corp is, it's basically a benefit corporation. It's one of the highest levels of certification that you can get that demonstrate that as a business, you're operating at the highest environmental standards, social standards, and also delivering great business results. And it's a whole host of measures, but it looks at how you as a business operate your value chain end to end and looks at everything from your team internally, your supplier base, your customer base, partners, as well as the community that you're part of. And there's a number of different dimensions. Why we were passionate about doing it was quite simply to create a North Star for our organization that made all of the work that we were doing contribute to something really important, not only to our consumers who are looking for businesses that really have that mark of quality and standard, but also to our own team members. We're in the middle of COVID. We're considered essential products. People were working 24/7 just trying to keep lines running. And I wanted to find a galvanizing force at that time. And now many have said to me, how could you ask your team to take up a mantle like that when we were just struggling to keep things going during COVID? But in many ways, it was the most galvanizing of all forces. And I remember when I said, look, we're passionate about triple bottom line, that is profit, people, planet. Let's demonstrate that really actively. And what if we could become a B Corp? It's been the domain of very amazing but smaller companies in this country and actually globally. What if we could prove that we could be a force for good with our scale by becoming a B Corp? So that's, then we embarked on the journey, and 2 years later, and frankly, a bucket load of heavy lifting, we managed to achieve that. So yeah, super proud of that.
And that's creativity, right? So and it's also kind of quite useful, isn't it? Like to even think that you could do that, I find really interesting at an organization that size, which is quite a few years ago. And at the time, it was just a kind of a fringe independent kind of companies who were becoming B Corp. So that, how did you make that decision? Was, did somebody come up to you and say, hey, we should be B Corp, or you're just mulling it over? How to inspire our people? Was it an internally driven thing, was it?
Look, I have to start by saying I'm incredibly grateful for the fabulous team at Unilever and ANZ, but also some of the supporters offshore who kind of back some of my harebrained schemes like this. So whether it's what they work week, right? Because it does require a coalition of the passionate, willing and able to conspire to make these things happen. And what is really important to note is whilst I stimulated the idea, and why did I want to do it? It's because it's hard for any organization that's investing in sustainability, and this is not new to Unilever, you know, we've been doing this for a very long time. But rather than us saying that we're doing something good, not perfect, but good, you know, progress over perfection, I wanted there to be an external certification that actually validated everything that we were doing very objectively. That's the first thing. Second thing, played devil's advocate. So when we actually worked with B Corp, we were able to say, gosh, there are areas that we are really nailing, right? We're doing really, really well in this space. But then others, where you also had to take a deep breath and go, oh, wow, we need to reimagine how we do this because it's not good enough. That's an inconvenient truth right there, like a higher level of discomfort in recognizing that. But people were energized by, gosh, the what if? What if we actually pulled this off? And the people that really made it happen, the change agents in our organization, were, yes, of course, we had the support of the leadership team in ANZ, but it was really people right through the front line of the business that put up their hand and said, I want to do this and I can contribute in this area. And, you know, and magic happened.
We do a little section on this show called the pub test, where we take our guests' work and see if it passes the pub test.
Right.
For you, we've taken the concept of Unilever becoming B Corp and seeing if that concept passes the pub test.
Okay, cool.
Let's have a listen and come back to this amazing kind of transition you've done.
What do I think of Unilever becoming a B Corp? Well, I think it's just all linked to make capitalism palatable.
I'm not still entirely sure what a B Corp is, but I mean, I feel like the intention's really good. Corporates don't have a really good track record when it comes to self-governance. So yeah, I'm not quite sure what I think yet.
If you look at some of the products underneath their umbrella, Domestos or Tresemme, these products that are bad for the environment, like I didn't really think that fit in with the B Corp ethos.
I think it's good that Unilever signs up to B Corp status, but like, what is the status like?
It's a good sign that they're signing up. It's a good sign of intent.
Hopefully all of their production and manufacturing things are like held to a certain standard, and that it does become better for like both the environment and for the people working for them as well.
I think they'll just do the B Corp regulations. I don't think they'll go above and beyond for the environment or people.
It's hard to tell if Unilever will actually change all of their ways, or whether they just got this kind of B Corp so they can smack it on their products to seem like a good company.
I mean, I think it's pretty hard to do what's in the best interest for profits and planet and people
sure if it's like a small step towards taking down capitalism, it will pass the pub test.
I mean, I think that the concept passes the pub test, but, you know, maybe the proof is in the pudding.
But I think they're good conversations to be having with your mates about these huge corporations. I think, yeah, it passes the pub test.
A bit of cynicism there. What are your thoughts?
Like, I think it's super helpful to always do reality checks on sort of intent and impact, because sometimes your intention and the way that it lands can be disconnected. Look, I welcome feedback like that. It keeps us really honest in terms of making sure that we communicate what we're doing. Look, I can assure you, B Corp is an incredibly difficult process to navigate, and we needed to change many things in our supply chain to be able to get that verification. So have we met minimum standards? No, we've gone well above that. And that said, have we scratched the surface of what needs to be done? Absolutely. But as I said before, I'm a massive believer in set the vision very clearly, make progress every single day. And we can't do everything all at once, but we can do everything over time. So we're picking the things where we can have the most impact. And then we're partnering with customers, with partners, with suppliers, because this is not something that any organization can do on their own. So, yeah, look, I think more work to be done, but beyond that, consumers should keep companies honest, right? I think it's important to have a very strong consumer voice.
I think that was pretty good. I mean, I was expecting more apathy from the pub about what a B Corp is and who cares. I mean, that they sounded to me pretty. I feel like they were giving you the benefit of the doubt that this is actually a good thing, as opposed to being, yeah, there's a bit of cynicism. And then, of course, there always is around every big corporate, you know, big brand. But I thought that was pretty good, actually, for the B Corp placing the pub test. Do you reckon, Adam?
Yeah, I do. I actually don't think it also, I think they're the least important voice for our outcome. I can't believe I said that in this conversation at the moment. I think what's important is that Unilever knows what they're doing, and the people working at Unilever and any B Corp know what they're doing.
Correct.
And then I think all of that kind of flows out from there. And what the comment I loved was, organizations are terrible at regulating themselves, and so you do need independent certification to keep you honest. I love that. And I totally agree. Corporations get away with what they can. And so to pay an organization to police the industry, I reckon is a good thing. I reckon that is walking the walk or whatever, walking the talk, whatever the expression is.
I kind of wanted to also future-proof a little bit so that, you know, when I wasn't in the seat, there was still that obligation to meet all the certification. The other thing I would say about B Corp is you have to get recertified every 3 years. So it's not like forever and a day, that's tick that box. No, it's like, so the team in ANZ right now are going through the next level of certification. So it's not a slam dunk. You get it. You actually have to make progress.
How much does it cost, Nikki?
It's not a certification that you pay
for. You can't
for.
Buy it, Adam.
Not buy
certification. I mean, what does it cost? I imagine there must be some form of licensing fee or something, or else B Corp as an organization couldn't exist. So they need some money. So it must come from B Corp companies. But then the second part is, what does it cost in terms of, you know, you're mentioning changing supply chain and all that kind of stuff. Like, what's the outlay to be cheap?
Yeah, look, let me start with that second point, which is when you want to, like, have a regenerative impact on the planet by reducing your emissions or by, you know, significantly reduce the amount of virgin plastic and moving to post-consumer recycled, you know, any number of different choices. Because of the, in some areas, the nascency in this country, you are paying more for post-consumer recycled plastics, for example. So I've got a very simple ethos on this, which is when you are going to be adding costs into your supply chain because you're doing the right things for the long term, then we as a business need to find non-added value costs elsewhere in our P&L to be able to fuel that investment. So I'm not satisfied as a CEO that we are just adding cost without thought, because then what inevitably happens is it gets passed on the consumer, and that's not right. It shouldn't cost the earth, and pun intended, like it shouldn't cost the planet, but it also shouldn't cost the earth the consumer They shouldn't have to pay more for sustainability. So we've got to get really smart as a business in terms of how we make it affordable.
Case, any other Unilever, has any other country in Unilever well done it, or just Australia and New Zealand?
Just Australia and New Zealand at this point.
Wow. Well,
but Unilever globally, of course, has very high standards around sustainability and social impact. You know,
but not as high as Australia and New Zealand.
Well, I think we've just gone that extra mile to get that B Corp certification at this point, Adam.
But they didn't pay for it. But they didn't pay for it, Adam. All right, just to be clear. Hey, sorry. As you reflect, Nikki, on your time as the CEO of the Australian Zealand business, what are you proudest of?
I'm proud that we set ourselves a target to demonstrate true triple bottom line impact and that we were able to do it. I'm really proud that we got B Corp certification, which really showed that we could have that positive impact on planet and on social impact as well. We did deliver some really strong financial results during that time. And I'm equally excited that we pioneered the first, you know, the 4-day work week, which was
Let's talk about that.
4-day work week. Look, for those of you listeners that might not be aware of it, in a nutshell, it was this. We pay people 100% of their salaries to work 80% of the time, as long as they deliver 100% of what we agree are performance outcomes. And those performance outcomes range from, you know, financial to cultural to, you know, et cetera.
Yeah.
The reason we wanted to do it was because we wanted to see if we could find a productivity amplifier that came from a sort of well-being platform. And one feeds the other. Now, it's a pretty awesome gift, right? Up to 48 days a year back in your day to do what you will want to do with it, as long as you opt in to these ambitions that we've set for our organization. And it's been really, really successful. We started it in New Zealand. We've now extended it into Australia, and we've been doing it for about 3 years, and we've seen some really exceptional results off the back of it. The one thing I will say here is, because people have often said to me, oh, Nikki, that's, you know, that's kind of nice giving your team a day off a week. But that wasn't the point. The point of the 4-day work week was to actually remove all the non-value added BS that sits in an organization. Processes, yep. Projects, you know, protocols, politics, all of that, that get in the way. Because when we can remove 20-25% of the trap capacity that gets caught up in stuff that doesn't matter, then we can actually free up the capacity to do a few things better.
And what was the most practical, simple thing that you had to do to unlock the 4 days a week? Was it meeting times? Was it, what are some of those sort of simple things that we waste time on in businesses that you just were able to get rid of?
Meetings were one of them for sure. Like, you know, just pull out meetings, you know, have conversations, make decisions, push decision-making down, like genuinely empower people. We rewired processes. We stopped a lot of stuff. We stopped a lot of innovation. We stopped a lot of projects that were pet projects but not creating value. Like we stopped a lot of things. And people felt uncomfortable. I felt uncomfortable at times, right? As a CEO going, gosh, if we stop doing that, is something going to fall over? And you realize quite quickly that it doesn't. You also realize it's a two-way door, right? If it does, we're going to quickly catch it.
And productivity up, I'm sure culture's up, wellness is up. Yes. I mean, on every metric, has it delivered?
Yeah, growth is up. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, and that makes it sound completely rose-tinted. Along the way, we had to, you know, as you talk about companies governing themselves and holding themselves to account, you know, as a leadership team and right through the organization, we really held people to account. You know, when things weren't working, we jumped in and pivoted. We had some principles in place, which was, you know, we didn't say everyone could take Friday off. Absolutely not. We need coverage over the course of the week, because at the end of the day, we need to be available for the customer that we serve and the consumers we serve. Therefore, you need to be all in. If something goes wrong, guys, we need everybody in the office. We need to fix things. You know, you treat people like adults and they behave like adults. So amazing things then come.
Adam, I remember when advertising was a 4.5-day week. Is it still?
No. I think what's really interesting about this is increasing, maintaining that. God, you know, the way you frame things, you're a fantastic communicator. So maintaining 100% productivity, but going down to 80% of the time is I love that. I think what's happening is in the advertising industry is the really long hours is just not tolerated at all anymore, as they should have been. But being able to maintain productivity with shorter working hours is, I think, the key. And so getting rid of the waste and stopping doing things, again, I just really like that.
But the big difference, like having worked on both sides, I mean, the amount of wastage in a corporate, a big corporation versus a small advertising agency, I mean, they're night and day, mate.
One of the sayings we say is we get it wrong less. And we like to get it wrong less because just working at previous agencies I've worked at, the amount of work that we would do that would never see the light of day freaked me out. Yeah. And every bit of that work that is just the little piddly agency at the end of the food chain's doing, there's all these massive work streams.
Yeah.
And the wastage is just phenomenal. So I could imagine stopping stuff is almost your biggest challenge to increase productivity. Nikki, when you're the CEO, you're not the CEO at the moment, you've got a global transformation role, but you've been the CEO a couple of times. I get the impression for you, it's not lonely at the top. I get the impression that you have a band of merry people around you who you work with. Is that right? And where do you go for creative ideas? Because I don't imagine you going to an ad agency saying, "Hey, give me an idea." But who's your creative spark?
It can be lonely at the top if you allow it to be. And yet, you know, let's be honest, I could probably not turn up one day and the business will still continue. You know, our factory teams or our frontline sales force don't turn up and it has a material impact on our business, right? So I know the role I can play is to unlock the potential right through the organization and to be that person that brings the outside in, some thought leadership, stimulate new thinking. So I sit on a couple of boards, and the reason I do that, you know, World Wildlife Fund, Global Sisters, is because, because they're causes that I'm passionate about, but I also get to sit with people around the table that I normally wouldn't get the chance to engage with in organizations that are very different to the one that I'm part of, and to give me access to ideas that I may not have considered. Husband, my kids, my friends, a really good source of inspiration. I like to read, listen to podcasts. And, you know, quite honestly, sometimes the best ideas come, you know, from binging Netflix or going for a walk or, you know.
Do you have somebody in the organization who you go, "Hey, let's think about this. What are we going to do now?"
Yeah, you know what? Like but for different things. And they, you know, some of them are around, like I've put a lot of my energy and effort in trying to create the right team of people, particularly around the C-suite table, but also below. Like one of the things that we did at Unilever was, and I've done it in other businesses that I've led, is almost have like a shadow board, if you can imagine. So that shadow board, maybe 10 people that come from the organization, they're usually from many functions in the business, but not senior, right? Real frontline. And we would share with them some of the decisions that we're grappling around at the C-suite table and say, "Well, what would you do?" And honestly, like, we've taken different decisions off the back of some of the insights that were just blind spots for us. You know, that whole notion of sometimes your strength can become your biggest weakness. Like, my 27 years of experience can be awesome, you know, capability that I bring to the table, or it can be my blind spot, right? Because I think I know how things are. I think I've done it before. I think I know the solution. And so beginner's mindset's important. And so I surround myself with different people, depending on the problem, that can help me bring a beginner's mindset to the table.
What's your ambition? Do you want to be the global CEO of Unilever? You're not really allowed to say that. It's politically, you have better words than I will to be able to say that. What do you want? Where do you want to stop?
You know, without wanting to sound trite, like my very honest answer to that is that I define success in my life, and particularly the older I get, from a combination of things. One is to continue to feel fulfilled in my career, but it's also really important to me that I have a great relationship with my husband, with my kids, that I have a social life, and that I contribute to things outside of Unilever. So I don't know. The really honest answer is if I can contrive a life for myself that is rich in all of those aspects, then I will feel successful. And if that allows me to continue to nurture my career corporately or outside of the corporate world, then happy days to that as well. But I'm less linear, I guess, around what that might look like.
Legend.
Hey, Nikki, we like to end this show with asking our guests to sum up their creative mantra in a way they can put on a black t-shirt. Now, you've given us some great soundbite today. It's a funnel, not a tunnel. Bring a beginner's mindset. But like, what would you put? You're going to put on a t-shirt that you're going to proudly wear around the streets of Balmain, Sydney. What would it say?
I'm going to credit my two kids with this because at the beginning of every year, we in the like in the spa shop family, we kind of come up with like a mantra for how we're going to life. Yeah.
For the whole family.
I've got a decade of them. So it's super, you know, super nice for me to have this. But the one for this year is also the one that I would put on this black t-shirt. So in order to unleash your creativity, be a chocoholic monk. So by that, I mean, go really.
Be a chocoholic monk.
Yeah. Be really imaginative and bold and creative and unconstrained with your ideas, and then be disciplined around the few that you think are going to make a difference. Execute with excellence to last mile detail and measure what you treasure so that you know that it's actually giving you results. So that's be a chocoholic monk.
You gave us about 7 t-shirts underneath that first t-shirt. But I think that's the most creative answer we've had to that question, Adam.
I think Nikki's been just about my favourite guest of any of the series. And I shouldn't say that, should I?
That is like high praise from you, Adam.
It's fantastic, Nikki.
I love all our guests, Adam.
Me too. That's better. It's incredible. Like what you've done and what you're doing, what you're continuing to do is extraordinary. So congratulations and thanks for taking the time to share it with us.
Yeah, really, really inspiring, Nikki. Thanks so much for taking some time out and having a chat to us.
No, thank you. My pleasure. And thank you for inviting me. This has been fun.
I mean, you said it during the chat when you said she's such a great brainer of things like great sound bites, really clear communicator. I think that for me is inspiration when marketers become CEOs, that they're able to communicate in a way that's really sticky and really memorable. And I think if you work for her, really inspiring, right?
Yeah. I think for me, my favorite bit of learning out of that was the one elephant used to be the challenger. Now it's a whole little bunch of starfish stinging you. Not jellyfish. Now I get that and I love that because it's so visual and so concrete, and her communication ability is phenomenal, but she's not communicating shit. You know, she's communicating massive changes, the likes of which corporate Australia doesn't see that often. So B Corp, largest organization globally, Unilever, largest organization globally, become B Corp. 4-day weeks, and there's been a few other things she's done as well. It's genuinely inspiring, right?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, when we think about, this show's about creativity, and often that gets defined as, you know, creative advertising. I mean, this is creative leadership of a company, right? This is proper creative leadership to do the things that as you say, Unilever can become a B Corp. That is proper creative, disruptive thinking, right?
100%. 2 more things. Number one, fire setting is the third pillar of that psychopathic triad. So if your child is setting fires, bedwetting, and cruel to animals, you're all three.
Yeah, that's a future. Then they're going to be a future leader of a holding company. They're going to be a psychopath.
I think Nikki made it very clear she was helping that bird. Not killing it.
That's right.
The second thing is, I do just want to come back to this trite argument about CMOs becoming CEOs.
Yeah.
And whether it's increasing or not, let's not go down there, but it is increasing.
But what I find really interesting is organizations are now having to try to orientate themselves around brand and the consumer, and they're getting it. So board positions are opening up for CMOs. Lots of my clients are now CEOs through CMO organizations. And you know, so big airlines and big, you know, betting companies and various things where you'll see they're all ex-CMOs.
Yeah.
And I reckon there's a massive change happening where people are going, oh, brand stuff is important. And I think it's happening at the same time as they're being under pressure financially, where they have to get on more intangible value, because that's the only way the businesses are going to survive.
And yes, all you read about all the time is the CMO role is dead. CMOs aren't taken seriously. So it's really interesting, right? You have that such optimistic view of it, and you're feeling that it's shifting, and brand is actually having a more important role in the boardroom, in the running of companies. And yet all the narrative you read is opposite. I mean, we're the most self-sabotaging industry there is, right?
That's right. And I guarantee you there are more CMOs becoming CEOs now than ever, but that is not the rhetoric.
Not the narrative. Not the narrative.
And boards are clamoring. So it used to be the CMO trying to understand the language of the board. Mm. The board is now going, oh, shit, that CMO person who understands the consumer and the brand, shit, they've got all the answers. How do we get more of that in our organization?
You are filling me with hope and optimism, Mr. Ferrier.
On that, well, let's stop now then.
Exactly. Exactly.
All right. Good to chat. That was fantastic. God bless you.
And you, my friend.
Take care.